All right, we are back here at Radio Parallax, and in this segment, we have our old friend Vlado Zarevica returning to talk to us. Welcome back, Vlado.
Thank you, Doug. It's good to be here, as always.
We like to clear up matters that are controversial, great mysteries, or something that we like to delve into. And on this segment, Vlado is going to help us as we examine an enduring mystery of Americana. And it involves a topic that certainly is preying on all of our minds of late, that of air piracy, hijacking. There is a case, anyone who was alive at the time I think remembers, dating back to 1971, involving the legendary, now legendary, D.B. Cooper that's still rattling about in America. Cooper's case is the only unsolved crime of hijacking, air piracy, on the books.
Yeah, he never was found, although there was a massive manhunt at the time, and none of the money, or most of the money, was not recovered, if I remember correctly.
Yes, none of the money, none of the $200,000 involved in this case has ever turned up, with one interesting exception. But let's actually, you are a pilot, you fly for a living.
Yes, I do. In fact, the same exact aircraft that was hijacked, type of aircraft.
Oh, good. Well, then let's kind of go through a bit of review and then kind of update this case, because there has been a very interesting update in the past few years. There are actually a couple of documentaries that are going to air. They've been postponed in the wake, of course, the 9/11 tragedy, feeling that it's too sore of a topic to go into at this time. But they will be airing at some point in the future, and we're going to basically beat you to the punch on this and tell you what we know. Okay, let's go back. It's Thanksgiving Eve, 1971.
Correct.
On a
Northwest Airlines Boeing 727.
All right, a Boeing 727 on the ground in Portland, Oregon, on a flight to Seattle, Washington. Among the passengers is a man who said his name was Dan Cooper. He signed in as Dan Cooper. Due to a little bit of a snafu later in the reporting, when it was later revealed that the FBI was looking into local people named Dan Cooper, and there was one man named Dan B. Cooper who liked to go by D.B., the reporter falsely assumed they must be looking for D.B. Cooper. Well, no. His name was Dan Cooper, and it just got a little bit... the legend has been sort of mixed up along the way.
And continued to grow and stuck.
As it often does. Dan Cooper got on board the aircraft, and basically at some point after they took off, passes a note to the stewardess. The stewardess thinks that as a middle-aged man, someone trying to pick up on her perhaps, which I'm sure happens frequently to our flight attendants. She basically pockets the note like, oh, brother. And apparently, there's conflicting reports. He leaned over, realizing she's not reading the note, and says to her, "Miss, I have a bomb." She then sort of realizes, uh-oh, I'd better pay attention to what's going on here. He then opens up his suitcase and shows her some cylinders with wiring, and all of a sudden, life has changed for everybody on board the aircraft. It's interesting to recall that at this point in 1971, they didn't have metal detectors.
Those did not start in usage until 1972.
Right, and I believe in the wake of Cooper, people realized that, oh my God, you can slip a bomb on board an aircraft with too much ease, and therefore we started having lines after that, reminiscent of more recent history. People were complaining, oh my God, I got to go with a metal detector, something we all now accept as sort of part of flying. In the old days, in the good old days, you walked right on board the aircraft.
Correct.
Dan Cooper has basically commandeered the aircraft with threat of having a bomb on board and starts passing notes up to the cockpit. And they're then given instructions as to what is to be done. The cockpit is informed that you fly up to Seattle, and I would like to have $200,000 in cash and four parachutes.
It is interesting that he picked four parachutes, and I'm sure that that kept the authorities from jury-rigging a one parachute.
Because is he going to take a stewardess with him?
Correct.
We don't know. We can't give him a bogus parachute and figure he's going to die in the attempt. We have to give him a legitimate one.
Correct. This crime was obviously well planned out before it was executed.
Yes, and it did inspire some copycats afterwards, which were all of which were unsuccessful.
Correct.
Well, they land the plane. The FBI does produce $200,000, which they, on high-speed copiers, make copies of every single bill.
Correct. And they had time to do that because the cockpit crew had radioed ahead as far as what the demands were and what was happening, the fact that there was a hijacking situation in progress.
And they apparently circled the Seattle-Tacoma airport several times. Apparently, none of the passengers were aware that this was going on.
Probably not. If he was just passing notes back and forth, and that was the primary communication. Also, it's not uncommon to have to circle SeaTac before landing there because of the weather in Seattle.
Well, they land the plane, they offload everybody, I guess still not knowing what's going on. And what's interesting to me is that apparently the flight crew, looks back and realizes they can bolt off the aircraft. But the stewardess is still back there, I guess, talking to him or whatever, and can't just, you know, be gotten off with the crew. Now, you're given some training, I guess, in regards to...
In the hijack training that I have been given with various companies over the years, first of all, the overriding training that we were given is whatever you do, cooperate.
Right.
If you cooperate with the hijacker, do whatever they tell you to do, 99% out of the time, the results will be good.
Which, of course, has now tragically changed.
Correct. The second thing that we were told, if on the ground, obviously, and you have a chance to escape, in the 727, both forward windows have emergency exit latches and a rope, because it is 15, 20 feet off the ground. If you do have an opportunity to escape, do so, because what that'll do is it'll ground the aircraft. It'll incapacitate it, and then the authorities will have more of an upper hand in dealing with whatever the situation is.
Right.
Now, I do not know. My training has been in the past 10 years. I do not know what the training was 25 years ago as far as dealing with the hijack situation.
Hijackings had been taking place before that for some years. The first, I guess, case of flying to Cuba is, if my memory serves me correct, 68, perhaps?
That sounds about right.
So this has been going on, and I guess they hadn't quite firmly worked out what to do. At any rate, the crew can't get off, and the money is brought on board.
I would say the crew chose not to get off.
Well, right. They could have left the stewardess back there and bolted, but being chivalrous individuals, I guess, they decided they didn't want to leave her in danger, and they stayed on board the aircraft.
Correct.
Now, I understand this is not quite, it's different if you're in a military aircraft.
Some of the former military pilots that I have flown with have told me that it was their understanding that should a military aircraft ever be hijacked and on the ground, that one of the primary defenses that the military uses is to deploy a sniper team against the crew. If it looks even all possible that the aircraft can be taken off, the military will not allow one of their, or at least the Air Force, will not allow one of their aircraft to be hijacked if they have an opportunity to do it, to keep it on the ground.
Right.
And that opportunity is usually incapacitating the crew.
Well, when you consider that a military aircraft would possibly also contain weaponry.
Correct. Even nuclear weaponry.
Yes. At that. I hope to heck that these guys in the military aircraft have windows that pop out with ropes also.
Yes, they do.
Okay. Well, the plane takes off. They've got $200,000 on board. The hijacker, Dan Cooper, is sitting in the back drinking bourbon and chain-smoking Raleighs. He tells them to fly toward Mexico. He tells them to go to 10,000 feet, to put the flaps to 15 degrees, and to lower the landing gear.
It shows that Dan Cooper, again, did his homework, because if the flaps were kept at 15 degrees, that limited the airspeed that the pilot could maintain the aircraft to keep the flaps from ripping off. So he did his homework. He knew exactly what he was doing and to keep the aircraft in the exact configuration and speed that he wanted it.
Now, I read an account, which I don't have access to, of one of the pilots that was on that plane. And I forget what he was trying to do. He was trying to do everything he could to screw Cooper up. Like, he was trying to fly as fast as he could at that configuration. He was doing things. He was trying to kill Cooper any way he could. Instructions were given to fly toward Mexico. I guess he was advised that it wasn't enough fuel to get there. They'd have to stop in Reno, Nevada, and I guess he agreed.
Correct, especially with the gear and the flaps down.
Right, that you'd be like trying to drive with the emergency brake on.
A good analogy.
He asks the stewardess, as he's, I guess, between his glasses of bourbon and chain smoking, to show him how to lower the
rear air stair
door. Yeah, the stairway in the rear of the plane. And she shows him how to do that. And I guess he then tells her to go back into the front and to ignore what he's doing and just get behind the curtain and stay up there near the flight crew. He apparently then lowers the stairway. He's last seen by a surreptitious peek to be strapping apparently something to his waist, presumably all of the money.
Correct, the money bag.
They come. The captain comes over the intercom and asks, is there anything we can do to help you back there? He shouts back, no. Goes down the staircase and leaps off into history.
And this is, again, showed his planning, the fact that the Boeing 727 at the time was one of the only, if not the only aircraft at the time that had a rear air stair.
Right.
Which, by the way, Boeing has made modifications to it, and now there is a device on the outside of the aircraft that's actually activated by the wind as it's rushing by the aircraft that prevents the rear air stair from opening in flight. And the name for this is the D.B. Cooper vane.
You know, I remember on 727s how convenient to go down the rear staircase instead of having to fight your way to the front. That was a good feature.
Yes, yes, it was.
And damn Cooper.
Well, they still, you can still use the rear air stair. And in fact, at some airports, they where there's not a jetway, that's still a viable point, but I'm sure that, especially with this aircraft security now, the desire is to have as less people, civilians, walking around the tarmac as possible.
Yeah. Well, Cooper leaps off. Now, there's, of course, naturally, like all great mysteries, there's all sorts of theories as to what happened next. Now, by the time, it's interesting to me, you may have some insight into this, that by the time this was all going on, obviously, he takes off in a 727. He's flying slowly and low. They scramble fighters to go after him. They're trying to chase him. It's Thanksgiving. It's November in the Pacific Northwest. The weather's dark and stormy. And they never see anybody depart off the rear stairway of the aircraft. They don't know anything is up until, I guess, he lands in Reno or whatever. And they realize he's not on the airplane anymore.
Correct. A man-sized object falling off the rear of an aircraft, even traveling at 170 miles an hour in a storm at night, would be very, very hard to spot unless he's wearing Day-Glo orange and has reflectors beams pointed at him.
Right. Well, the FBI agent who was still in charge of the case all these years later was in a chopper trying to follow, and they couldn't get close enough. So Cooper disappears into history. The $200,000 has never turned up, except with one exception we'll mention, and there's great speculation that he surely must have been killed. However, they sent out hundreds of agents to comb the area, which is near the little town of Ariel, just north of Vancouver, Washington. They believe that's where he, you know, got out of the aircraft. Actually, they did find numerous dead bodies out in the woods, apparently.
Yes, they did.
Which were you know, other lost hikers and people who had been dead for years. But they never found Cooper. They never found any evidence of him. So people have thought he got away with it. And unfortunately, that's pretty much where the case stood. Until the one and only break took place in 1980 when an 8-year-old boy playing on a sandbar in the Columbia River near Vancouver, Washington, finds almost $6,000 of the Cooper money in tattered and rotten bills.
This is true. And the boy was allowed to keep some of that money, was he not?
They gave some of it back to the insurance company, and the family got to keep some of the money. I think he has 15 of the original 20s, which he could sell it on eBay these days. I hope he hung on to those, because that's quite a keepsake. So D.B. Cooper has become something of an American folk hero in a strange sort of way. Nobody was harmed by his antics. It was a very bold criminal effort. Certainly no fatalities. The only people hurt was an insurance company, which, let's face it, people don't have a lot of sympathy for.
Correct. And he stymied the FBI.
Yes. Now, the FBI has claimed ever since that surely he died, because I guess when he left the plane, it was something at 10,000 feet. It was like 7 degrees on a cold November night. With a wind chill of 170, they said that would have been like 70 below. He was wearing a suit, ill-prepared for bad weather. How could he have survived out into the woods, they say? He must have landed hard. He's still out there. But people, a lot of folks, have been combing that area. A lot of, you know, mountain men and hunters and things. A lot of folks would like to find $200,000. Interestingly, they claim that, well, perhaps some of that money washed down the watershed into the bank of the Columbia River. I find that to be somewhat unlikely.
Exactly, because it would have been scattered all over the place. Nah, it wouldn't have washed away in clumps in $6,000 increments.
Well, you wouldn't think so. Let's fast forward to the last. Well, there was several reports on this. U.S. News and World Report commented on this in July 2000, and the 30th anniversary of this event was last November, so it got some attention up in Seattle. And what's curious about this case, U.S. News, the issue was called Mysteries of History, and this is certainly qualified, and said that perhaps this case has been solved. It turns out that a woman in Florida who married a man in 1977, he had a discharge, dishonorable discharge from the military. He'd served time in prison. His past was a little shady. He'd been married, I think, at least five times before that. And she actually married him and, I guess, made a successful relationship out of it for 17 years until he was dying of kidney failure in 1995, when on his deathbed, he said to her, "I am Dan Cooper." Now, the nation knows him as D.B. Cooper. This didn't register with him. Who's Dan Cooper? She didn't know what he was talking about. And he sort of exasperated said, "Well, let the secret die with me." He also made a comment to her with other witnesses present that he'd buried $173,000 in a bucket and he couldn't remember where the bucket was. Something I think anyone who lives in chaos and clutter can relate to when you go to put your hands on something. And his wife, whose name was Joe, this man's name was Dwayne Weber. His wife, now widow, Joe Weber, wasn't sure what to make of any of this. He passed on. He did, by the way, chain smoke Raleigh's, and his preferred drink was bourbon. If you take a look at Mr. Dwayne Weber and you look at the reconstructions of D.B. Cooper, you have to go, well, it is suggestive. He does look like the guy.
That he does.
I'm going to try and get a hold of his widow, because I read somewhere that he had some military experience with paratrooping, but I couldn't hear that confirmed anywhere. The FBI says, look, this doesn't prove anything, but there's some interesting aspects about this. Joe Weber stated that in 1980, they took a trip to the Pacific Northwest, apparently a sort of reminisce over some things, is what her husband told her. And they went out, and at one point, she recalls him stopping and going down to the river all by himself. Interestingly, this appears to be pretty much in the same spot where something like 6 months later, this boy is digging in the bank and discovers all of D.B. Cooper's money. This has people very curious, saying, well, this does seem to fit in a rather interesting way. The wife noted that she had seen in his personal effects a year before he died a ticket out of Seattle or some of the Pacific Northwest. She was unable to find that. There was a money bag, similar to the kind that banks use, that also disappeared. Nothing concrete turned up. The widow's left saying, gee, because she has nothing to gain from this story. And when in relating this odd tale to neighbors or friends, like a year after he died, one of them said, well, maybe he's D.B. Cooper. You know, Dan Cooper, maybe. And then the wife's kind of going like, gee, I wonder, had never put two and two together and led her on this path to say, gee, I think my husband was this guy.
And she did go to the FBI with this information, did she not?
Yes, she did. The FBI opened a file on it and said, that's very interesting, ma'am. But, you know, if you ever study American history or the FBI, what you'll discover is the FBI has one concern, first and foremost, is don't embarrass the FBI. Now, this is a guy that basically tweaked their nose, got away with it, and, you know, their investigation has been somewhat lackluster, saying, well, we can't prove any of this. Well, his widow has basically been on the web asking for help, saying, look, the stewardess that was back there with him should be able to say whether the pictures of my husband look like the man. But nobody can find her. She's basically disappeared.
Now, what did you say the FBI said concerning the evidence, that it was inconclusive?
Inconclusive. Well, the reporter for the Seattle Post-Intelligence has sort of said, well, geez, they ought to try investigating. Maybe they find something a little more conclusive than that. The FBI sticks to the story that with that kind of a wind chill, a man unprepared could not have survived.
Having spent some time in Alaska, in extreme cold weather, you have to realize that if he did jump out from 10,000 feet, he's not going to be spending 45 minutes exposed to this wind chill.
No, he's not.
In fact, he's going to rapidly decelerate, so the wind chill will go away.
Yes.
Because he's going to be going from 170 miles an hour. He'll slow down to almost no horizontal velocity.
Right. They were guessing he had maybe 15 seconds exposed to that kind of ferocious tornado-like wind.
I have just on a lark rant while in Alaska when it was 49 degrees below zero Fahrenheit, in shorts and barefoot, ran out of the apartment, threw the garbage into the trash can, and ran back just to see if I could do it. I was able to handle 49 degrees below zero Fahrenheit for at least 15 seconds with almost no clothes on.
All right. Well, you know, I'm inclined to believe that the mystery of D.B. Cooper has probably been solved. I look at this picture of Dwayne Weber and I say, gee, he does look like the guy.
He does. He does. I'll have to agree.
So my inclination is to think that it probably has been solved. I think what happened, and it's actually easy to imagine this, he stored away the $173,000 and forgot where he put it. That's actually, I can relate. Interestingly, too, that when the story broke, the widow noted that when the story broke of the $6,000 being found, her husband made the comment that, like, that money's no good.
Ah.
She didn't know what to make of it. And I was just going, okay, whatever, how would he know?
Maybe he assumed that was part of the money, that part of the money was somehow marked and he had written it off and buried it separately or just left it.
Well, it certainly must have come out by that time that the money was marked. And he must have known that to try and spend it would require going to Panama or somewhere would have been very difficult. And who knows? But anyway, we're going to do a follow-up story on this because it's a very interesting matter. Air hijacking is something that we all have to live with at this point, the potential of it. And here's one case, unlike, you know, the more recent, tragedies in America, that has basically elevated to someone to basically the status of American folk hero.
Doug, there's one point that I am a little bit disappointed in, Dan Cooper. With all of the planning and thought that he put into this, he didn't, and research that he did, he forgot the lessons of the pirates of yore that you should always make yourself a treasure map.
You know, the question is, where is that bucket?
Where
Imagine
is the bucket?
The energy that's been expended looking for Captain Kidd's fortune, you know? I mean, I'm sure that if you found that bucket with all those marked bills, the insurance company would be happy to give you a cut.
They did to the little boy.
They did. All right, well, we're going to follow up this story. It's a very interesting mystery of history that I'm satisfied this one's probably resolved.
I agree with you.
Stay tuned. We're going to follow up on this one in the weeks to come. Well, that's it for this week's show. This is Radio Parallax. I am your host, Douglas Everett. I'll see you again next Thursday at 5 o'clock, I hope. This show was produced by the now award-winning producer, Edward McMillan. Assisting me today in the booth was the volunteer staff here at KDVS. Stay tuned for Gina with Electricity and Lust. And I think for our betting music, as we waft out of the program, we will do something appropriate for the saga of D.B. Cooper, a song I always liked, Beyond the Blue Horizon.